This is Harry Murray at Murray's Fly Shop in Edinburgh, Virginia, with our sixth podcast, which we're doing today on December the 20th. What we've done thus far in our podcast was start with the tactics that we'll use throughout the various streams early in the year. Then what we're going to do is go all the way through the season in about 12 podcasts on the trout fishing. Then we'll do a whole nother series on the smallmouth. Now, we've covered in previous podcasts the tactics for actually spotting the fish in the stream, separate podcast on reading the water, and also on the food. Now, we're marching on down through the season. What I'm going to cover today will be in the small streams from the middle of April until June. Now, when I say small streams, I'm talking about streams that are probably 20 feet wide and the pools are about 20 feet long. This would cover some of the major streams throughout the Appalachian Mountains. If you're up in New York, this is a little salmon, little chasey. If you're down in the Smokies, it's Abrams Creek. If you're out in the Rockies, this would be the upper reaches of the Gardner, the upper reaches of the Shields, that type thing. These are small streams, and what we're going to do here is go through with the tactics. Now, I like a delicate rod for this. I usually use a fly rod. It's about 6.5 to 7 feet long that has a number 3 line. Most of the fishing I'm going to be talking about today, I'll use a 9-foot leader tapered down to 5X, except when I get in the latter part of this talk today, I'll probably be tapering down to 6X. Now, approach that I feel will be beneficial for you is to actually trace the hatches. In 2 weeks ago, we talked about the hatches of the Quill Gordons and the Blue Quills in Virginia throughout the Appalachian area here, because they start probably in the latter part of March. Now, since I'm talking about mid-April on here today, these hatches are still on. The Blue Quill and the Quill Gordon are still on. In fact, they actually become much heavier. So I'm way through. The Quill Gordon probably has the largest number of aquatic insects of most trout streams on the East Coast. These are very, very heavy. One evening, William Downey and I were hiking out of a remote stream in the Blue Ridge. We'd been probably 3 miles up in the mountain, and we had to get out before it got dark. As we came back down the mountain, we were looking out over a very, very deep canyon to the west, and the sun had already dropped below the tree line, and the Quill Gordon spinners were so thick out over that stream, doing their mayfly dance up and down in the air, that we actually just stopped and watched them till it was almost dark and then headed out of there. Now, when you're fishing the Quill Gordon, we're talking about water temperature that's probably up to 45 degrees by this time. Well, when you're talking brook trout, that's go, go, go. So these fish will be back on feeding stations, the lip of the pool, the tail of the pool, especially in the back eddies, the corners, which we went over all these earlier. So if you're not quite sure what I'm talking about, just jump back to that. In fact, on the website, we've got a picture of those. But these feeding stations are very productive. I move into the lower part of the pool and then cover each one of these feeding stations with either a Quill Gordon or a Mr. Rapidan dry fly, both of them in about a size 14 is pretty accurate on that. Now, the Blue Quill also overlaps this Quill Gordon hatch in the middle of April. The Quill Gordon, of course, is much, much larger than the Blue Quill. These, however, can be very, very heavy in some streams. One stream I fish, I've seen them so thick in there that if they have cold weather and the duns kind of wobble out on the stream, they're not energetic enough to fly away, but actually they swim over to the side of the stream and dry their wings and then fly away. I've seen them so thick along the side of the stream that I was almost afraid to walk up on dry land because of stepping on them. I'd actually watch where I was stepping so I didn't step on the little blue quills. We mentioned the vulnerability of these flies in the back eddies when the air temperature gets low and they get locked back in there. You'll always find some big fish feeding in the back eddies when it gets cold like that. Now, very, very few. So it's one of those things you'll just have to be observant. Now, the unhonest hatch that starts in the middle of April is the March Brown. This is the Stenonema vicarium. He starts in about the middle of April. So at this time, you've got the Quill Gordons, the Blue Quills, and the March Browns all overlapping each other. One time I was crawling up a mountain stream and came to a big SUV-sized boulder, and I peeped up over the edge. And now, this is a pool that was only about 20 feet long. In front of that boulder, there must have been at least a half a dozen trout on feeding stations feeding on dry flies. Well, I didn't know whether they were taking the Blue Quills or the March Browns or the Quill Gordons. Watched real closely, and they didn't care. Any mayfly coming down the tube, they were going to take. And I sat there and watched them a long time and finally did take a couple of them on the Quill Gordon dry fly. But these are excellent hatches. A tricky thing goes on with the March Brown. Without getting real heavy into entomology, what happens with the March Brown nymphs? A little bit before time for them to hatch, they'll move from their midstream home under the boulders over toward the sides of the streams to hatch out. Now, this concentration of nymphs along the side of the stream, and with some duns coming off at that time, really pulls many of the big fish over to the side. One day, my fishing buddy Downey and I were fishing in a stream, and we'd met back for coming out of the mountain that day, and Downey said, "Well, did you see all those nice trout doing something crazy over along the side?" Well, now, Willie is a wonderful fisherman, but he never did really get wrapped up in entomology. And I said, "Well, Willie, I think they were fishing with taking nymphs over." And he said, "Well, they sure were, because that's what I ended up taking them on." But you'll see a disturbance along the side of the stream in water maybe about a foot, no more than 2 feet deep. And those brook trout will be over there sipping those duns in or taking the nymphs. The nymph I like on that is the one that we use up in the Catskills a whole lot that Art Flick came up with. This is just really the March Brown dun in about a March Brown nymph, I'm sorry, in about a size 12. But Art Flick's pattern is really excellent on that. In fact, in the upper part of the Schoharie, one of Art's favorite streams, the upper part of the Schoharie right around the mountain from his home, we had fantastic fishing on these. Also had the upper part of the Schoharie can give you great dry fly fishing on the March Brown hatch too. So just play that game the way it falls. Now, following the March Brown, 2 weeks later maybe, you start seeing a number of gray fox showing up, which is well matched with a fly by that name, and then you'll start seeing some of the light Cahills. Now, these are kissing cousins. They're all in that Stenonema family. But the hatches really aren't as thick in the areas that I see that the March Brown is. Now, a friend of mine was very heavy into the Quill Gordon. Some of the streams he fished, he was very much into the light Cahills, because a lot of the streams he fished had very heavy hatches of light Cahills coming off. And he actually played a light Cahill nymph throughout the major part of that hatch and did extremely well. Now, these, of course, are all mayflies, but now there's a sleeper that overlaps all of these, which is that little yellow stonefly, the little isoperla stonefly. These are very heavy on many streams. Now, the little yellow stonefly is a very, very fragile insect in the nymph stage. He lives in debris along the side of the stream, moss on the rocks, that kind of stuff. Consequently, if you have a rock-rolling flood late in the summer, you may not get many little yellow stoneflies in the coming spring. This year, we had a very great season in the mountains, so I expect great hatches of little yellow stoneflies this coming year. Now, watch for fish rising to take these on the surface and go one-on-one. If you don't see fish coming up, drift your flies along the sides of the stream where you see mossy rocks. I'm talking about underwater moss now. Underwater moss on those rocks. Just drift your fly along through there. I still like the Murray's little yellow stonefly in a size 16, and I do fish these on 6X. But now this hatch, although I'm tracing my way all the way through the spring now to the summer, it's not at all unusual to see little yellow stoneflies on probably in June and sometime even in July. They do thin out as the season progresses, but the little yellow stonefly on many streams is an outstanding fly. Now, the Mother Nature sort of saved one of the best to the latter part of this time period, and that's the sulfur. This is actually there are four different flies in here that we call sulfurs. The one I usually think about is the Ephemerella dorothea. But there are terrific sulfur hatches both in the mountain streams and in the spring bred streams. These start sometime the latter part of April, but by the middle of May, they are very, very heavy. The sulfur mayfly is very special to many people. When I think of the sulfur, something that comes through my mind basically is just respect. This is not just respect for the hatch, but probably as much as anything, respect for some of the fine anglers that got me into this. Joe Brooks and Donald DuBois showed me the ropes on this throughout the mountain streams here in Virginia. When I started fishing up in Pennsylvania, Charlie Fox, Marinero, especially Ed Shank, showed me a lot of good information on the sulfur hatch, even in some cases showing me where a particular lard fish fed almost every day on the sulfurs. In fact, in Charlie Brooks's great little book, The Rising Trout, that he did in, let's see, Charlie did that, I think, about 1967. He refers to the sulfur hatch as the hatch of hatches, which I think is very, very well said, because some fine anglers all across the country have really gotten so wrapped up in this that it's just amazing. Some people refer to this as a sulfur philosophy. Now, let me talk a little bit about the tactics on these on the sulfur hatch. Sometime you're going to get into some very, very large fish on this. It's wise to carry a landing net. A real good friend of mine, John Snyder, called one afternoon and said, "Harry, I got into that big brown up there that we've been after for all spring." And he said, "I finally landed that fish." And I said, "Great day, John. How big was that fish?" He said, "Well, he was a little over 8 pounds. Now, this is a small Pennsylvania stream. Any open to the public, by the way. Anyway, John said, that's the biggest brown I've ever caught. And I said, "My gosh, John, how did you land that great big fish in that little tiny stream?" And he started giggling. He said, "Well, the big fish got so confused when he started upstream, he only went about 20 or 30 feet, and he stopped." And he said, "Right away, he turned and came back downstream toward me." He said, "All I did was stick my landing net in the water, and the fish swam right into it." Well, that was probably great planning on John's part. But anyway, you do want to use a landing net on these big fish when you're in the sulfur hatch. Definitely have a flashlight with you, because you're going to be on the stream till dark and maybe even a little later. The flies we use. Going back there again, I like to read way back. Many years ago, I read something that Charlie Fox was working on a pattern to use there in the Pennsylvania Spring Creeks, and George Harvey was working on a better sulfur pattern, and both of them were a little reluctant to tell the other one what they were doing, because some of the patterns they were coming up with were a little out of the ordinary. And finally, George pressed Charlie to tell him what he was doing. He said, "Well, you won't believe it, but I'm putting an orange body in there." George kind of giggled and said, "Well, I'm kind of ashamed to tell you what I was doing, because I'm putting an orange hackle on them." So today we realize that in some of these tough hatches on very, very well-educated fish, that the orange body is preferable. In fact, when I did the Murray sulfur, that became part of it. Now, there's some great books out on there. Hatches really covers a lot of this. Selective Trout that Swisher and Richards did goes into some great details on this. Some of the popular patterns that are used throughout the country now would be the pale watery dun, the sulfur dun, those type patterns. Harvey sulfur, Ed Shank sulfur is a great pattern. And of course, then I like mine. Basically, mine consists of that orange body. I use fly right in an orange body, and then I pick up some blue dun hackle and a blue dun wing to match the natural. When you're kind of reviewing some of these older patterns, the Tup's Indispensable has always been a great sulfur pattern. If you want a good laugh, go look up the Tup's Indispensable and find out what that name Indispensable means. It doesn't mean what you think it means. Okay, now let's talk about the strategies. I'm going to talk about the mountain streams, then we'll get into the spring-fed streams. In the mountain streams, this hatch is one of the heaviest and one of the longest-lasting we have. The duns start coming off about the middle of the afternoon. Spinners come back about an hour before dark. Now, the hot time to be on the stream for this hatch would be the last 2 hours of daylight, because you've got both duns and spinners. And the fish do feed very heavily on them. Now, my son and I were camping one time over in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we didn't get over in the mountains until late in the day and had hiked in a couple miles, and I was preparing to set our tent up before we ran out of daylight. Well, Jeff got rambunctious and grabbed his fly rod and headed on up the stream. About 5 minutes later, he comes running back down the stream. I thought he was being chased by a bear. He said, "Dad, you got to get your fly rod and follow me." Well, I followed him on up to a long pool. This was a long, narrow pool boxed in on both sides by real steep ledges. And in this pool, there must have been close to a dozen brook trout out there feeding on sulfurs. And as I say, there were both duns or spinners out there at the same time. We took maybe about half of those fish and then proceeded to spook the others while we were fighting those. But as we worked our way on up the stream until we ran out of daylight, we had fantastic fishing. In fact, for the next 2 days we were camped in there, this was just outstanding. Some of the guys call this last 2 hours of fishing on the sulfur the golden hour. And this is really good. Now, the peak activity on this is probably going to be mid-May into early June, and as I say, this can last as much as 6 weeks. They do taper off as the season progresses. Now, when you're getting into the spring-fed streams, and maybe even the tailwater, like Smith River down at Bassett here in Virginia, some of these spring-fed streams, some of the tailwaters, have great hatches, but when the hatch starts, we'll say 2 hours before daylight, sometime the fish are not really out on the heavy feeding stations. They'll be lying back against the bank, against the grass beds. They'll sip in what comes, but they're not ready to move out into the open water. These fish can be tough to spot. They do what I call exhibiting a half rise form. You know, a rise form is that concentric rings that you see looks like somebody dropped the BB in the water. Well, these guys snuggle over under the banks and under the edge of the grass beds before the hatch gets real heavy, and although they're going to take them, you do not see the regular rise form that you normally see. This basically is just a little bulge over there, but these can be some big fish. Now, once the hatch gets going, they'll move out into a little bit more open water between the grass beds or maybe even in the tail of the pool, something like that. And they'll work on these. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful. As the season progresses, these fish get very, very selective, and they're very drag conscious. So you want to use a very careful approach, a delicate cast to drop it a couple feet up above the rising fish. I like to use a puddle cast. Vince Marinero taught me years ago how to use a puddle cast. Basically, you're just aiming a little bit over the stream and let the line fall in the puddle. But that gives you a natural drift back down to the trout. Now, many of these fish, as the season progresses, now there again, we're talking about getting all the way in here to the 1st of June. The streams are getting lower, the fish are getting more selective, and they're getting more spooky. So often, I'll actually go in on my hands and knees. Now, where the hatch is very thick, the trout will often adapt the feeding rhythm, where they'll come up almost on the clock, bang, 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 and take them off the surface. Now, if you're drifting them over a fish and don't get a strike when you think you should, sit back a minute and watch and see if that particular fish is on a feeding rhythm, and then try to make your presentation coincide for that. Now, with all these things going on with the hatches here on the sulfur, you can easily see why Charlie called this the hatch of hatches. Now, that completes our podcast for today. Next week, we'll take this same podcast, same time period now, the same time period, which would be mid-April to the early part of June, and we'll go into the larger streams. If you have any questions on any of this, please give me a call. I'm in Murray's Fly Shop in Edinburgh, Virginia, and we'll be glad to help you any way we can. Thank you very much.